I think the startup world kind of allows for a bit more authenticity and vulnerability maybe than the corporate world. Nobody is expecting you to be perfect all the time or at every single area of the business. And once everyone kind of internalizes that up front, then everyone can kind of improve and perform to their best abilities.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. If you're new around here, if you dream about being an entrepreneur or you run your own business, then you've found it. You're in the right place. This is the podcast you want to listen to. Every entrepreneur I meet shares one trait. They're willing to experiment, fail, learn from that, and try again. And every week, I am privileged enough to chat with incredible entrepreneurs and find out what experiments helped them build some of the world's best companies. And this week, I'm chatting with Dee Lines, the founder of Examfly. I'm going to tell you a secret. So if you are listening, maybe just make sure no one else is around for this bit. Every season in my head, I play a game and I pick a company that I would like to invest in. It's like a little pretend VC game, venture capital game. And spoiler alert, here's the secret. It's episode 3. I think we have a strong favorite already. I loved everything about this episode, about this entrepreneur and about this company. Examfly are working in the online education space. So obviously, I do a lot of teaching. I work with Trinity College and places like that. So it was already interesting to me even before I met Dee. Dee is a rare unicorn. She has the insights and discipline of a corporate operator combined with the spirit and soul of an entrepreneur. You are going to love this episode. This is my chat with Dee Lines, the founder of Examfly. First, quick thank you, as always, to my sponsor for 2022, Sage. As an entrepreneur, you need to be leveraging tools and software to run your business as smoothly and efficiently as possible. That is why I'm delighted to partner with Sage for this season of the pod. Sage is the global market leader for technology that helps small and medium businesses perform at their best. To learn more about Sage, go to sage.com or click the link in the pod description. Dee, welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much, Gary. Big fan of the pod, so it's lovely to be here.
Oh, it's always nice to get that in at the start. I feel better already after leaving you hanging for probably 10 minutes of technical issues. We've done 100 and I think this will be 180 plus, and that is the worst technical issues I've ever had. So I'm sorry.
No, it happens. I've been there, so all good.
Stresses me out, but we're here. Dee, welcome to the pod. What do you do?
I am the founder and CEO of Examfly. At Examfly, we design interactive online learning tools to help people doing professional exams and in corporate learning generally, starting in subjects like tax and accounting, eventually moving to any domain that involves skill acquisition. So I think one thing I always say is that edtech from the outside can seem like the most boring of fields, and we double down on that by going into something like tax and accounting.
I was going to say, at least you picked two sexy subjects to start with, though, so it's okay, it balances it out.
Exactly, we're in the hot areas. But fundamentally, we believe that education technology is in its infancy versus where it will go. Most of the solutions to date have focused on taking existing stuff and just putting them online without really much attention to how people learn or how their attention spans, for example, have been affected by social media, modern internet use, all that. So, well, from the outside, it might look boring. From the inside, we feel it's an interesting domain.
Well, we'll get into it. Don't worry. We'll make it interesting. This is the perfect thing to talk about because I've been doing a lot of teaching online and it's damn hard. It's bloody hard because like all the reasons you just said, attention span, it's not the same. Like, it's not the same sitting here in the room teaching people. It's not the same for people sitting at home learning. So where did this is obviously a very perfectly timed idea now, but obviously you didn't start now. When did this start?
Well, I studied law in college and then trained in tax and PwC, worked in wealth management and investment firm. And I suppose all the way up along, I had been like, I'm fairly academic, so I never really struggled with exams. When I first got into training in subjects like tax and wealth management, like, I did find that the return on investment I was getting from the time I spent studying, like, not great. And I did fine in years 1 and 2, probably developed a good methodology in year 3 and ended up doing very well. And I lectured after that. But the problem I noticed persisted when I was looking at students. So correcting exams, tutoring, that kind of thing, I could see that people were putting in a lot of time to these subjects and not necessarily getting a return on the time that they were studying. In addition, I thought there was like a high barrier to entry from people who weren't from these backgrounds, for maybe you had a parent that was an accountant or a tax consultant or something like that. At the same time, firms were trying to diversify the people they hire, but there is kind of a harder barrier to entry if you don't have an original frame of reference. So while I was kind of building up my career in lecturing on the side, I suppose I've been looking more into the science of skill acquisition and also into technology. Two things in particular. One, like what the internet is doing to our brains. So there's a very good book called The Shallows, which consolidates a lot of the studies in that way. And we're just going to say that our ability to focus on dense technical things, even our ability to focus on interesting things, has gone way down. And I noticed that most learning models didn't recognize that. Instead, they kind of expect the learners to be superhuman and to focus where on the outside, they're getting dopamine hit after dopamine hit from their phones, but yet they're getting none of that from learning materials, particularly in these subjects, which are quite dense and technical. The second thing is the science of skill acquisition would say that the way you should acquire skills is very much like building muscles in the gym. It's built around repetitions, not passive learning where you're just watching something or listening to something, a talking head PowerPoint. That it has to be built around testing yourself, getting stuff wrong, learning from your mistakes. That's what builds the neural pathways. So like through a mix of, I suppose, my own kind of recreational reading and looking into things technology-wise, science, skill acquisition-wise, I had this idea and it wouldn't go away. I'd always been fairly entrepreneurial, and although my corporate career was going well, like I'd always had this itch that I wanted to scratch. So that's what kind of brought me to the idea of ExamFly, that it could be the learning journey for dense technical subjects could be made better through technology and creativity.
It's weird we're having this conversation now. I literally had a similar conversation with a friend of mine this morning about phones and how it's affecting our ability to focus, even as you say, on other interesting subjects. You know, your phone is just drawing you in,
a film or book.
And it's like an addiction. You're almost like going, why did I pick that up? And I didn't pick it up for a reason, but you just find yourself doing it by just. And I've seen it in even in classrooms when it was in person, the attention span is low anyway, but then it's much lower now due to phones. So I find it myself, and I definitely see it in others. Is this a permanent thing? Is this how we're going to be now?
Well, the science, unfortunately, would kind of say that it is. Like, so Nicholas Carr, who wrote The Shallows and consolidated that education, what he would say is that human beings throughout history, the tools we use aren't neutral objects. They change how we perceive, conceptualize the world. They change how we do things. And human beings like want to kind of do things the quickest and fastest way possible. So like the way we take in information now in our phones, on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, whatever, is the quickest kind of, like sometimes quite a low resolution way of taking in that information. So our ability to sit down in front of like a big book, you know, dense technical text legislation, it has been affected. And it's not to say that what we do compromises on the technical learning that the students have to do, but we give them the information in a more digestible way, try to replicate some of the dopamine that they're getting from their phone, from social media, from the internet, and so on. Because we felt that most learning models kind of just denied that and said, here, just take your book and sit down and stop complaining.
Yeah, and it used to be the thing with the Leaving Cert, right? And it still is, you know, take it down, take it in, regurgitate it back out. You're done. You know, and you find yourself, you're able to do it short term and then it regurgitate it back out. It's got a little bit better in colleges, I think. They have evolved the model a little bit, but it still is a lot of that kind of, okay, take this on board and now.
Yeah. And on that point about regurgitation, like for skill acquisition, like people confuse, I think, learning and skill acquisition.
Yeah.
The learning that we had to do for Leaving Cert very much was take it in and kind of spit it out again. For skill acquisition, it's all about taking on the theory to apply it in context. And that's the way these subjects, like to be a good tax practitioner, accounting practitioner, law practitioner, it's not enough to know rules in isolation. You have to know how to apply them to real life scenarios. And that's where technology can really come in, that you give people interesting gradated ways to test themselves that's backed up by tracking, analytics, adaptive learning, where you personalize the learning journey to individual strengths and weaknesses. And then from the firms who employ these people, you know, they can have a picture of individual or collective strengths and weaknesses. So there's a lot more that you can do with technology, I think, that than has been done to date.
So you're kind of almost reversing the trend. You're using the trend, but in a positive way. So you're taking it on that this is probably here for good, you know, technology's here for good, but how can we use that for a more immersive learning? So turning that into a kind of a positive rather than...
I think so, yeah. More immersive, more backed by the science of skill acquisition. Like, one thing about COVID, I think it accelerated the move to online learning, but it also highlighted that not all online learning is created equally. And we aim to be really just pushing the boundary of what online learning can be, where it ticks the box of being in service of skill acquisition, gives an engaging user experience, but also is employing technology in a useful and smart way that's for the benefit of the learner and the firms that employ them. So yeah, I suppose that's kind of where we sit at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be better timing, because like you say, COVID has propelled it forward. Like, online learning, we're suddenly like, oh yeah, it makes total sense. You know, you're not going 2 hours away just to do for an hour lecture. You know, people can study different things from different places. But also, I think it just highlighted the weaknesses of, okay, we've just taken me standing at the top of the class teaching 40 people and just put that online without any of the, like you say, without any of the realization of, well, that's not really going to work. Longer term, okay, it'll work short term, because people will adapt, go, oh, this is just like college grant. But I think what you're doing in incorporating the lecture, especially over a longer period of time, I think it's definitely going to be more fundamental. Like you say, in the gym, you don't just read the book about, those, oh, this is what nutrition, oh, this is how you say eat better. This is, you know, you don't just read the nutrition book and you're automatically better at nutrition and you suddenly feel lose weight.
Yeah.
How did you get this idea going, though? Because it's quite a big idea. Mm-hmm. It's quite a, you know, it's quite a meaty idea. So how did you get it going?
Yeah, I went through the kind of standard, like, Enterprise Ireland path. So I started at New Frontiers Phase 2. I'm sure your audience are well aware, but it's where Enterprise Ireland support you with some money and workshops over 6 months to try and get something from idea stage to, quote, investor ready. And the concept behind it is either... from working at it at the end of the 6 months, you realize that you're flogging a dead horse, in which case, great.
Which is good too. Yeah, that's okay.
Go back to the day job. Yeah, yeah. Or that there is enough promise to continue with it, in which case you can seek further investments. So after that 6 month period, so I'd left my corporate job. We were successful in getting the Enterprise Ireland Competitive Start Fund. So that's where, again, I'm sure your audience are familiar, 50 grand in funding for 10% equity in the company. And then shortly after that, we signed up our first major corporate client with our first modules. And we raised our seed round towards the end of 2020. So it was all in the middle of COVID. So I guess we were maybe lucky in that way, that it was kind of... unusually for EdTech, it was a hot area for a while.
It really was.
That whole thing.
EdTech was the space, because you said earlier, like, oh, EdTech's kind of boring, it's not as sexy. It was like, for a while there, it was the thing. People couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah, and we were raising our seed round at that time. And I suppose, like, yeah, I wouldn't go much by trends, but I think we were, like, a little bit helped by that, because people, when you say to them, I think they get it intuitively that a lot of EdTech is just putting the existing thing online. We aim to do something a lot more ambitious. Even what we had, like, our product set, a mixture of, like, these animated explainer videos, kind of model off Kyrgyzot. It's kind of, in a nutshell, it explains kind of physics and things like that online, and our kind of interactive games. We had some modeled on casino games like Fruit Machines. Even our kind of very early stages of product, they could see that there was something different here, particularly for these subjects. They could also see that we were already making inroads with, I suppose, what they would consider very high value customers. who have now become repeat customers. So like some of the big four accounting firms, we're in like two of the big four now in Ireland, as well as some major educational bodies and smaller firms. So I suppose just things came together for us nicely. Well, I'd like to think it maybe would have happened anyway, but yeah, we did
You covered a lot there in a very brief moment of time. Bring me back, because this is a question that people send to me all the time about guests. Like, how did they know when the time was right to leave their job? Because people send in, oh, I've this great idea for a business, but I've got a good job. Tell me about that process. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell my history. If I was giving advice to someone, I'd probably tell them to do it a bit differently. But for me, it was almost like a compulsion. So like, you know, my kind of previous jobs, even part-time jobs, if I was doing admin work or in office or working in a bar, like I'd always be noticing ways that something could be improved. And then I would, if I was leaving the job, you know, even if it was a part-time bar work, I'd, you know, be handing a list of suggestions to the manager, who I'm sure was like, what the hell, and just like throwing it like directly into the bin. So for me, my corporate job was going well, but I did kind of notice that, you know, in terms of kind of getting meaning or in terms of things that I wanted from a job, like, this probably sounds weird, but like I wanted something that I cared about enough and like found intellectually stimulating enough that I would think about it all the time. And although like I could do my corporate jobs and get on well at them, like I didn't have that. Yeah, so it felt almost like a compulsion that I had to go and scratch that itch and do something myself. I mean, if I was advising someone now, I would say definitely pay attention to those feelings. You could do it in a way that caps the downside risk a bit more than I did. You know, when I left kind of impulsively, you know, there's lots of ways to kind of educate yourself about the startup ecosystem, like podcasts like this, all your guests, you could like literally send a LinkedIn invitation to every guest here, even if only 10% of them had a conversation with you, your knowledge of the ecosystem will be 10 times more. But yeah, it felt like a compulsion, and like I always would have done something like this one way or the other. So it just kind of happened when it happened, and I wouldn't say I thought about it too much.
Compulsion's a really interesting word. It can feel like it's in a good way. It's a compulsion in a good way. How did you do it? Because you kind of alluded to it there. It was almost like a spur of the moment thing. How did you or talk me through that?
I suppose I had been thinking about it for a while, and it was kind of coming up to the end of the year, and the job that I was in, an investment company, like no one leaves coming up to the end of the year, because end of year is kind of bonus time, and like I probably had one of my best years ever. So like by an objective standard, you know, you probably wouldn't But at the same time, with the arrogance of youth or whatever, it's just like, I don't want to sit here and take their money if I feel like I really want to be doing something else. So okay. I just kind of handed in my notice and left. And in a way, I honestly think that was a good thing, because there's nothing like a bit of need or necessity to get you working on the next thing. So when I was building up the idea for Examfly, that involved a lot of kind of pounding the pavements in Dublin, like going in and meeting firms, talking to these large accounting and tax firms, talking to their users and kind of seeing was there a need there, you know, and talking to developers, trying to get the early versions of the prototype built, because I knew that I kind of had to get it done because I didn't really have a backup plan at that point. So, yeah.
Good way of doing it, really. Nothing like an urgency.
No regrets in hindsight. Although if I was advising someone else, it probably wouldn't be sensible advice. But
but I think it brings up an interesting point. Everyone's different, and everyone's always like, "Oh, what's the one way? How did they know?" It comes back to knowing yourself, I think, and then that's not the answer anyone wants. They just want you to tell them, "Oh, December 13th, that's the day you do it." You know, I think it's knowing yourself, knowing you have that compulsion inside you, 100%. Knowing what you want to do it. Do I really want to do it? Do I want to do it a little bit? Do I want to do it a lot?
Yeah.
There's no one way. And people keep asking me, what's the one thing you learn from people? The one thing is that there's no one thing. The one thing is that everyone's different. Everyone goes a different route. For you, that's probably the best route. For another person, they might want to do 6 months, and then they'll decide to work part-time, and then they'll decide to use, and that's right for them. Mm-hmm. There's no one way. How did 100%. You validate that idea out? You kind of hinted out there, you talked to a lot of people. How did you go down the validation route?
Yeah. So the Enterprise Ireland, like New Frontiers program, they give you like a stipend, they call it, of €2,500 a month to kind of live on while you develop the idea. And that was enough for me to say, make the prototype of the product. So there's two kind of elements to it. The first is animated videos to do the information intake phase. So I was able to kind of make a couple of those to show it. And like with normal online learning, it's normally a talking head PowerPoint and some really boring slides. But if you have a talking head PowerPoint, the talking head is adding nothing to the information that the people are getting, where these subjects really lend themselves to showing things like ownership of assets, flows of money, and so on. So the animated videos, immediately, I was going around Dublin on my phone, like kind of basically going into these firms going, look at my cartoons. But like, I think people got it straight away because the cartoons were about like a tax thing or accounting thing. They could kind of see that even watching something for like 10 seconds or 20 seconds, you get a lot of bang for buck in terms of the information that would go into your brain. And then, yeah, just kind of, I'd met some developers on the New Frontiers program, just engaging them to develop early versions of some of the testing tools. So as I said, some of them built like casino games, like fruit machines, where instead of the variables that's been around being fruit in a casino, it's the variables that drive a tax outcome, like whether it's company, where they're residents, and what they're doing. Okay. So I was able to kind of cobble together, like I suppose, basic versions of the product and put together like a proposition to get our first corporate client who are Chartered Accountants Ireland. And yeah, I think all the time when I was having conversations with people, and I had a lot of conversations with people, there was no one that said, this isn't a problem. That there was no one that kind of said, oh no, my attention span is fine, I'm grand, or that, you know what I mean? So yeah. I was getting enough nods and eyes lighting up, even from showing the original, maybe not great versions of the product, that it encouraged me to keep going even before there was any kind of formal contract signed or even before we got investment. I knew there was enough promise to keep going.
How did you, because a lot of people, they don't get to that stage, they don't validate, but then they definitely don't put rubber to road and actually go, okay, now it's ready, I need you to pay me. How did you bridge that gap? How did you go from one to the other?
So for our first client, they, Chartered Accountants Ireland, they asked us to kind of, we'd been having a couple of discussions with them, which were more at ideation stage. And then they kind of said, look, we'll come in and tell us what the product would be and what we would have to pay for it, basically. So they kind of pushed the issue maybe before we were ready, but actually that forced us to kind of sit down and say, right, what is the product? What is it, a module? Is it a course? What's the flow? Is it a technology thing? Is it a digital media thing? How does it get set up and how do their users access it? So they kind of maybe forced the issue, which was good for us because it expedited the product development phase. So we put together a proposal of something we felt we could do. They accepted it. So we went from raising our first bit of investment, the Competitive Start Fund, and incorporating the company in October 2019 to launching with Chartered Accountants Ireland in April 2020. Okay. And then we were raising our seed round after that. So like the timing, I suppose, was very fortuitous for us because it was the middle of COVID. We had that whole kind of edtech is hot for a while kind of thing. But then we also had our first client, which was a big name. We were also in kind of advanced discussions with a couple of the big four accounting firms. So we were kind of lucky with how it all panned out.
Yeah, if you just added crypto and blockchain to that now, you would have hit the holy yeah, trinity.
There's some kind of genome sequencing thing as well. Throw that in.
But that thing of getting your first client, like, I think that's where a lot of people just wait because they don't have the confidence or they don't have that urgency. And it's hard because that is, as they often don't even get to that stage because that's the point where it can all fall apart. So they stay in that stage of validation.
I think that's a really good point. And actually, like, if I was to like look back and give my earlier self a bit of advice, I'd say, you're in a bit of a comfort zone when you're just talking, having preliminary discussions. It's low risk because you're not risking rejection. So it's in everyone's interest to get a bit quicker to this is the product, would you buy it stage, I think. Because either they will or they won't, you know, so.
And people are nice as well. They kind of try to like give you you know,
useful feedback.
Oh yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's really good. It's good. And you're like, how is it bad though? Tell me how it's bad. Because that's what I really need to know. I need to know why it's not going to work, as opposed to...
Or if it is, if it is that good, then will you pay us for it is the next logical question. So if you can kind of, get quickly to that point of this is the product, this or what it could be in 6 months, and would you buy it? Because otherwise I think you're in a bit of a comfort zone situation where you can get a slow no.
I love that.
Yeah. It'd be better to either get a quick no or a yes, I think.
I love that. That's a great phrase. So how did you build out the MVP? You kind of alluded to it there. You met some developers over New Frontiers, but how did you actually go about that? Because that's another phase that people find very difficult. Oh, I'd love to build it, but I don't have a developer. How did you get over that hurdle?
Yeah. And I was kind of a solo founder, non-technical. So I probably started with what do I want the end product to look like? And in simple terms, it was for the information intake phase that would be done by way of animated explainer videos. And for the useful practice phase, so building those repetitions, which remix the learning, go in, that would be done by custom games. So you need to find a developer for the custom games and then someone for the overall platform. I was lucky enough to meet the people on New Frontiers, and Gary, one of the guys working with Kian, were able to, I suppose, just patch something together on the WordPress platform using a bunch of custom code for the interactive games. Separately for the animated videos, I'd researched tools about how to create animation kind of a quicker, more seamless way. So there's a tool called Powtoon that we use.
Kind
of something like PowerPoint. You might have seen it. So it kind of gets the amount of minutes that you can create in a day with animators from maybe 1 minute a day up to 10 minutes a day, that kind of thing. Starting at the end product and working backwards, and then just talking to anyone who was maybe a second degree connection, even of a developer on LinkedIn. But I would say that there's an awful lot you can do with low code or no code tools to prototype things. For most people who are at MVP stage, like the likes of Bubble, you can kind of build out an app in a low-code development. You might spend a week teaching yourself how to use it, and then you could integrate it into a WordPress platform. It won't be the technology that's getting you millions at Series A, but to get a prototype into the market and into the hands of users cheaply, I think there are an awful lot of options. I think sometimes where people go wrong is that they go straight to a development firm and it's it's 20 grand to build this. And nobody has that at the stage, say, that I was at New Frontiers, where you could pay maybe someone, I don't know, in increments of 500 to actually get stuff done that you can integrate into a WordPress platform, because it allows you to plug in your own stuff and get something useful working there. So just kind of looking at the range of options that you can do, using some off-the-shelf stuff and a bit of custom code, you can definitely, with a bit of ingenuity, unless you're doing something very hard tech, you can get an MVP done quite cheaply, and you should be looking at the kind of cheaper options, I'd say, to do that.
I love this, because that's the bit that everyone kind of obsesses over. Oh, you know, it has to be perfect, and I have to get a developer, I have to find a development team, and there is so many tools out there. Okay, it's not going to be, like you say, you're not going to raise 50 million, but you'll get one or two customers out of it. And how did you combat that desire for perfection that a lot of people have?
That's a really good question, Gary, because I think that if you're kind of used to being high achieving in an academic sense or in a corporate sense, as I was, to be frank, that you kind of expect your first version of everything to be a 9 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10. We're in a startup world, by definition, you're doing a lot that's completely new the whole time. So the first version of your pitch deck might be a 3 out of 10 or a 4 out of 10. The first version of your product might be 4 or 5 out of 10. It can be very hard to kind of live with at first, psychologically. Just again, true necessity, I tried to internalize that as quickly as possible, because I saw how quickly stuff could improve through iterations. So while it might have really pained me in the corporate world to have an initial version, say of our pitch deck before we raised our seed round, and we were doing this 2-page brochure thing, the first version of that wasn't great than I had done. But then true giving it to people who had experience in fundraising. Roseanne, one of your previous guests, is one of them, like many others. Like, it definitely did, through iterations, get up to an 8 or a 9 or a 10. So like, and we raised our seed round without too much difficulty. So I kind of saw maybe quickly enough that my skill set was only going to take me so far, so that I had to be non-defensive and very open to getting help from good people. And I just saw it time and again. This is what I would say to any of the people that join Examfly, that don't worry if the first version is a 4 out of 10. Like, we'll put it through lots of testing, we'll get user experience input, we'll do whatever, but like, we'll get it up to a 9. That's just the way it works in a startup, because by definition you've a lot of people who are kind of not too experienced, just kind of operating a bit outside their comfort zone. And it's not to say that the thing you put in front of a client is ever like bad or not great, but the first version before it gets to a client, you know, that's your first version, and then you put it through all the testing in the world before it actually goes out there in the world.
I really like that. You have to have that bit of vulnerability, the ability to put it out there and not be afraid to get your feelings hurt by someone going, no, it's not great. Yes. But yeah, like you say, finding those people that will advance you along, but you have to put yourself out there, don't you? You have to be a little bit on the edge, whereby you have to feel uncomfortable. You have to embrace that. Is that something you did naturally, or is that something that you developed over the last couple of years, or where did that come from? Because it seems to be a high level of self-awareness here about what you're good at.
I think self-awareness, like, it's a function of age and, you know, like maybe some therapy. You know, like, you just have to kind of learn to like look at yourself and realize that your value to the world isn't that you're perfect at everything. Your value as a founder isn't that you're perfect at everything. And I think that did take me a while to learn. Like, we were chatting to a VC founder the other week, and he said that, you know, he found the company really interesting. What we had done was impressive, but that I might need to sharpen up a bit on the commercial story. And like, an older version of me wanted to, you know, curl up in a ball and cry. But like, now it's like, okay, grand. I think that's totally coachable. Like, I'll sit down with people who know about this for like a day or two. I'll sharpen up. It's fine.
Yeah.
I think it's a, like, not a function maybe of so much growing older as kind of the repetition of difficult situations, like in a startup. Like, you know yourself, Gary, you're out of your comfort zone so many times that eventually you kind of build that muscle and you learn to take things a little more non-defensively. And as well, that I think the startup world kind of allows for a bit more authenticity and vulnerability maybe than the corporate world, so that nobody is expecting you to be perfect all the time or at every single area of the business. And once everyone kind of internalizes that up front, then everyone can kind of improve and perform to their best ability. So
I think it's getting much better. I think a lot of people are, like yourself, are having a very open conversation here. I think people are much more open now about challenges they've had, how, you know, how things have been, how they've improved. You know, and you mentioned the word, they're coachable. I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs, and the really great ones have had that. They've had that coachability. Mm-hmm. They've had that determination. They have that steel in them. You kind of go, they're an operator, but they have that coachability. And it's a rare thing to be able to find the bite point between the two, because you naturally have to have this, like, this is going to work. This is definitely going to work. Mm-hmm. But equally, to be able to step back out of yourself and then go, okay, here's the three things you're going to have to work on this week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you've covered a lot of ground in 3 years?
Yeah, 2 and a bit, I think, yeah. It does feel good, and it's been like a great journey, you know. I think, like, I always wanted to kind of have a life where I look back and it felt kind of adventurous. Like, in a work sense, doing a startup is definitely that, you know.
You mentioned something there that people are probably like, ask her about that. You raised your seed round without too much difficulty. Explain that bit.
I do think we were quite lucky, Gary. Like, so we just got our first customer, Chartered Accountants Ireland. So that was in April 2020. And then I actually knew Roseanne Longmore of Coraflow from a previous life. So I'd been chatting to her, and she'd kind of said to me, look, this is the blueprint. This is how we raised money. You prepare your 1 to 2 page brochure. I can look at it for you, prepare your deck, see who's interested from one stage to the next. And she, I suppose, gave me a lot of confidence because she kind of said, look, based on what you've told me, I don't think you'll struggle. And say a couple of advisors who, one of whom actually had come about from a cold email that I sent him on LinkedIn. He's the head of the Irish branch of an international tax firm. He had indicated that he might be interested. So never underestimate a cold LinkedIn message. But the way it kind of went down was, yeah, I prepared all the materials and the financials. We had this kind of wind at our backs with the whole ed tech being in favor for a bit. I suppose I, as an introvert, was a bit lucky. I could do a lot of these pitches over Zoom rather than meeting people. And the first person that we talked to, you know, I thought like we'd have a nominee company, so we might be getting lots of 5, 10 grand, 20 grand maybe. The first person that we talked to, which was coming from that cold LinkedIn message, indicated that he would be in, and I thought he would say, okay, that's 5 grand or whatever. And I was looking forward to kind of ticking that off the Excel spreadsheet, like that's our first one. Then he kind of said, it'll be 100 grand. And I suppose I was just very lucky, the sequence, the way that it fell, because we had that kind of in our back pocket talking to everyone else. And we'd also kind of continued the discussions with customers. And, you know, I suppose the types of customers that we're dealing with, like people can kind of recognize from the outside, these are kind of what, like, I guess what gets called tier one enterprise customers. They're big names, and we could show emails that kind of indicated that we're close to tying up sales. So the rest of the money actually did come fairly straightforwardly with a lot of help from people advising me and making sure I didn't kind of trip up on the legals or the structuring of it. And then we had lined up Enterprise Ireland for the HPSU co-funding. So our seed round in total was 600,000 with 350 privately and 250 from Enterprise Ireland.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's considerable.
As I say, look played a big part.
Sounds like a little bit, but like the strategic way you approached it, like you can see Roseanne's fingerprints there on that. All right. You and her are quite similar in the journeys, but you just approached it with a very logical, practical way. And I think, again, some founders get a little bit lost in the weeds of afraid to get a no, maybe. But the strategy you put in place about having, you know, having customers, which is unique, a lot of startups forget about that part, and then having the commitments of tier one, but like going into a niche. I talked about this with Mary, who runs Tour America, like the importance of being in a niche. So clear, you knew exactly who you were targeting. You're not just EdTech for all. Oh, we can do degrees and we can do certs. It's very, very specific. That was the strategy from the very start, was it?
Yeah, I think definitely, and very deliberate. And I heard that interview with Mary and thought that was a really good point, that you don't do everything, but the things you do very well.
Yeah.
So like, if you look at online learning in two dimensions, like one is like recreational learning to professional qualifications. Recreational learning like Duolingo and stuff, if you don't kind of get the learning from those tools, then okay, big deal, you can't order your croissant from when you're in Paris. But in our case, we chose something with a very acute pain point. Like if you don't pass these exams, bearing in mind there's a 50% failure rate, like you can get kicked out of your job. You won't advance in your career. For the firms, they can't charge people out at a good rate, that kind of thing. And then if you look at it from the second dimension of like just putting the existing tools online or making it a really interactive, immersive experience built specifically for skill acquisition. I know everybody puts themselves in the top right-hand corner of these competitor analysis grids. We really did feel that we had picked something that was niche enough to have an acute pain point, but like that we could implement these, like the science of skill acquisition that in time potentially is more generalizable. Because the overall corporate training market is very big, but you start with a niche where there is a pain point so acute that people will pay for it. The broader you go, like it's great because you have a bigger potential market, but you sometimes maybe dilute your value that nobody cares enough, just enough to pay for it. So that's the kind of line that you're walking.
Yeah, the great phrase, sell painkillers, not vitamins. That applies to you so perfectly, because what people say they want and what people actually want are two very different things. Everyone's be healthy. Everyone's go for sea swims. Everyone's go running. But in reality, burger places do really well. You know, it's the same with this, unless it's very, very, very specific. And as you said, the pain point. What is the actual, I think a lot of pain points are kind of inflated, or, oh, I have that problem, so loads of people must have that problem. This is very specific, and it's binary. Mm-hmm. You either do or you do not. There is no kind of like fluffy kind of like, you know, middle, oh, it's fine. It doesn't really matter. You know, you don't, it's like you said it there with Duolingo, two very different learning methods. So for yourselves, extremely strategic. How did you draft this out at the very start?
Well, I had come through these exams myself, and I just knew that most people who are doing them, this is like hundreds of thousands of people globally every year, you're working full time. And the last thing you want to do when you get home or at the weekends is drag out these big textbooks or drag out the legislation. And like, if there was any way to make that quicker or more painless, and doing the past papers for the testing yourself piece is very psychologically unappealing, because it's either kind of all or nothing. You have to put in half an hour worth of work and then just try and match up your answers at the end. And if you haven't got stuff right, it's a bit like psychologically daunting. So most people don't actually do the useful practice, but they focus on the passive bit, which is less effective. So there is a lot of kind of problems that I kind of felt could be solved with technology, with creativity, a bit of digital media. And I'd suffered that pain point myself. Again, like, you know, this was always said by the firms that most people who fail these exams have never failed an exam before in their lives. You know, and I'd seen that maybe sometimes from the odd person in my intake or as a lecturer that happened. So I suppose it wasn't so much a strategy as just kind of knowing from first-hand experience that this is a pain point. And then from the discussions with the firms and the potential users, like, no one was contradicting it. Like, no one was saying, hey, this is a breeze. Or like the firms now, it's like a talent acquisition and talent retention issue for them, because they're competing for smart graduates with the likes of Google and Facebook and the tech companies in a way that they never were before. So they can do things that make their lives easier, then it's a win for everyone. So there's a few different angles, I suppose, that like where we come in and hopefully solve a problem for them and for the learners.
Such a good idea. What happened then? You raised the seed fund. What was the next step for you?
The next step was we launched with our first big four customer. So kind of built like our first few modules to sell to them, got our second big four on board, a number of smaller firms. One of the kind of main things that we committed to in our business plan was to hire a head of engineering, because this is a technology play rather than an education play. So the makeup or our org charts, current and future, will look different to that of a traditional education company. So that, because I didn't have really any connections in the tech field, or not too many, that took a bit longer than we thought, but eventually, through making connections, I wrote this kind of white paper about what I saw as our technical vision that got circulated among a bunch of kind of very talented developers, and eventually it found its way to Eugene, who ended up coming on board as our head of engineering. Ashling, who was a primary school teacher with a really solid acumen for UX, ended up coming on board as a learning technologist. So it's kind of building up the team. So when I raised the seed round, one of the main investors said is like, Dee, I think you've done well so far, but like, to be fair, you're like a glorified sole trader, so you need to build up the team. And like, I do think that like that probably was like a true comment. So yeah, building up the team was the main thing, and making more progress on the customer side. And now we're kind of looking ahead to see, right, how do we scale this? How do we systemize our operations? Because there's a high degree of creativity in any one module that we create. There's a high upfront cost. After year one, you know, the unit economics look better as you absorb the cost. So how do you systemize a process that is highly creative elements. You know, like some of what we're doing is like thinking of like jokes and bits of humor. It's kind of putting the animated videos. It's not scalable for me to be running like, you know, comedy workshops.
CEO/joke writer.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'd love to see your calendar.
Nine to nine thirty
investor meeting. 9:30 to 11 jokes.
Workshopping jokes. Yeah. So yeah, like how you do that. And so we're looking into kind of like different technologies, like natural language processing is one where we see huge potential. That has like come on leaps and bounds in the last few years. You've seen things like OpenAI, GPT-3, Google Path, where basically, you know, we could take these rules, which are text-based, express them closer to code, and speed up the translation effort into interactive tools and digital media. So currently, you know, it's quite a labor-intensive, involved process with subject matter experts, animators, that kind of thing. But I think there's lots of ways that that process could be improved. So the technology that we have at the moment, like we're really focused on making it good from like a user experience point of view and something fun to use. I think in future we'll look at how would we be able to quickly go into another domain like law or medicine and use technology to quickly create the modules that we need to. So there's a lot that we're looking at in that regard.
Amazing. Like there is, when you think about it logically, there's so many professional areas you can go into when you have this nailed down, you have the technology stack behind you. Like there's so many professional exams you'll be able to go into.
That's what we're thinking. And, you know, I suppose when you're talking to investors, again, going back to the point of me sharpening up commercially, but they kind of, I suppose, what they want to see varies stage by stage. So I think from like where we are up to now, it's great. You seem to have found something approaching product market fit, a lot of good user testimonials. You have repeat big name customers, but what's the next step? Because, you know, professional exams probably cap out at a certain level. What's your plan for expanding the market and getting quickly into new domains? So that's, I suppose, that's where the technology and the commercials are all connected, and that we're doing some work on at the moment, like with our plans.
What was it like, you touched on it there, effectively a sole trader, what was it like moving into having a team? And making that jump from it's just me to us, it's we, it's
yeah.
What was that like?
Overall, really good. And I suppose I maybe had like a little bit of apprehension about it because, you know, at the New Frontiers phase in my spare time, when I was like reading a lot about technology or looking at blogs about NLP and so on, reading about the science of skill acquisition, like a lot of my time was spent wandering around Phoenix Park, like drinking coffee and like just thinking about things. And eventually all those ideas and reading resolve themselves into like a product and then a business model after that. So I suppose when the first kind of team members came on board, Ashling and Eugene, there was this kind of apprehension of, okay, my day has to look a bit more like a regular work day now. And then I take the kind of responsibility to them seriously, their paychecks, the responsibility of the investor money seriously, the responsibility to our customers. So like looking back, you know, in those days around Phoenix Park, like I had no responsibilities. And like, I probably would have been thinking at that point, geez, I'd love to be where we are now, but it definitely does come with more responsibilities. But I think we've been so lucky that the people that we've gotten on board as the founding team members are a great fit personality wise, energy wise, communication style wise. So it's actually been great to share the journey and the ups and the downs with them. And to feel that, you know, if you do get a no or if you do get, you know, a comment that you're not pleased with, that you can talk to them about it and to see their development too. Like Ashton came from a background in primary school teaching, but she's picked up so many skills in the last like 6 months in user experience, coding, game design, so on. Eugene is like a self-taught, really, really impressive developer. Just to see him kind of looking at things like how we could use AI or NLP and seeing the first version of the platform come to life, like that's very satisfying as well. So Yeah, no, it's great. I think I will kind of have to mentally adjust to, you know, if we have a bigger team, if we raise more money later this year and all that. But I suppose you just adjust the things in stages. And yeah.
How did you find them? You mentioned you put a white paper out to find a developer. So how did you hire them?
With Eugene, I wrote a white paper that kind of set out like our current technology stack and the longer term vision. And that, again, through Roseanne, actually, and her CTO, that kind of found its way into getting circulated among a group of developers who have regular meetups. And what I've heard since is that it was interesting for them to see a non-technical founder who maybe had thought a lot about how you would not just have a technology in isolation, but how you would apply it specifically to a particular domain, the problems that it would solve. So that's how Eugene got in touch with us. And how did I, as a non-technical person, I suppose, end up vetting him or hiring him? So I got like one trusted person who'd been nominated by one of our investors to kind of, I suppose, put him through his paces on a technical front. And then I just knew from kind of talking to him and meeting him a few times that personality-wise and communication-wise, it would be a fit. In particular, because the way that he communicates is very empowering for a non-technical founder. You know, he's not trying to kind of explain things in the most complicated way possible. Like, you know, he'll just kind of very simply lay out the pros and cons of different approaches and potential risks and so on. So yeah, that's kind of how that happened. And then Ashling, her sister got in touch with me. We used to work together, and she mentioned that her sister was thinking of getting into STEM and wanted to have a chat with her.
It's quite broad, and, yeah.
So she ended up doing a bit of part-time work for us, just did an excellent job, and then ended up joining the company. So, like, although, you know, there wasn't that much engineering to it, like, I couldn't have asked for better two people, you know.
I think it highlights the importance of taking a fresh approach as well. People always, you know, take the same, if they're looking for a job or trying to hire people, they always take the same approach. You know, like, I've built my CV, cool, and now we're gonna do it, you know, or it's like, oh, I put up the job application, but we're not getting the right people. I'm like, okay, but have you tried other stuff? Like, and the power of building a good network. I think you've emphasized so many times about having a good group of people around you and slowly building those pieces, because you already probably have everything within reach if you just go at it a little bit of a fresh way and just ask.
Yeah.
I think that's the big thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Just ask. Just say, oh, I'm really looking for this, or I'm struggling with that. You know, we tend to shy away from having direct asks. It's like you said, the soft no, we're afraid to just go, yeah, no, I can't help you with that at all.
Yeah.
What does the next kind of 6 to 12 months look like then for yourselves?
Yeah, we're finalizing modules for the international market and starting to have discussions with the first international customers. And then we'll probably look to raise around at the end of this year, which allow us to, I suppose, have a full suite of modules. So at the moment, we've done it like a little bit piecemeal. We have 2 or 3, 4 tax ones, a couple of accounting ones, but we want kind of a full suite kind of backed by some of the more sophisticated technology ideas that we want to do. So make our first international sales, raise around like by the end of the year with a view to really getting in that professional exam wedge. And that in turn with a view to positioning ourselves like for the kind of broader corporate training market.
As someone who's in the full stages of startup, expanding, growing a team, how do you find balance?
I think a lot is downstream from, I suppose, your own kind of personal philosophy about what it is you're doing. So I kind of had to learn that at the start. You know, when you leave the corporate world there to go into a startup where things are very uncertain, where it might not work out, there definitely is like at least a temporary loss in money, status, all those things. So I had to do a little bit of work at the start to just internalize, no, this is the right thing for you to do or to try to do for your life. Like, this is what you were kind of meant to do, and whether it works out or not, everything will be good, and just enjoy the journey. And it's fundamentally a good thing to try and create something new and put it into the world. So the philosophy is one thing. The second thing, again, is like a lot is downstream from like exercise, physical health, how you treat your body, sleep, how you balance work with, you know, recreational stuff. So I do a lot of running, do a lot of walking, you know, I run with a running club, and there's some like competition for recreational runners, so it's possible to be like a bit of a big fish in a small pond. Like, it's not really proper athletes, but
it's always the best way to be, though. It feels good.
Recreational running, seriously. So yeah, between the kind of personal philosophy, between, I suppose, just looking after your mental and physical health, and I would prioritize those. And like, I do think that so much is downstream from the founders' optimism and energy levels, that like, for me to, you know, do my best for the investors and for the team, like, I have to kind of look after myself and like aim to have my own energy levels, my own mood as high as possible, because that seems to affect everything. I wouldn't say I get it right every day, but there are some of the components of it, you know. I think as well, like, on, you know, say on like the Twitter and things, I'd follow a lot of people who do kind of share a similar value system. So even if you've had a stressful day, you can sometimes just look and see a tweet that like just kind of reassures you. So Naval Ravikant, for example,
he's
this one. Yeah, don't take yourself too seriously. You're just a monkey with a plan.
Yeah.
Like, I love that. We had it on our whiteboard and work for one. It's like, oh yeah, it's because, you know, the monkey thing is like a nod to our primate ancestors, and we're hardwired with a lot of the like biology of them, but like, we as humans have this capacity for long-range thinking, which is also the source of a lot of our anxiety. So it's like, don't take yourself too seriously, you're just a monkey with a plan. I love it.
It's very good. You're very stoic, that's why I asked you that question. You're very stoic for someone that's in the maelstrom of like raising finance and you know, expanding and hiring a team. You're extremely stoic. You come across very calm and very kind of self-aware.
I've been like very lucky. Like, I have a lot of very good advisors, investors, friends. I've kind of gotten to a place where, you know, I kind of tried to live in a good, authentic way. So, you know, after that, things will work or they won't work. Like, I'll give them my best shot. But yeah,
it's just that
listening to your podcast actually is like, honestly, I've taken a lot of reassurance from your solo episodes and like, you know, some of your interviews as well. Like, that kind of feeling of connection. I'm not the only person going through this. So
yeah, thank you. Yeah, the solo ones are a nightmare. They're an absolute nightmare to do. They take me 10x what it should take me to do. I'm like, oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to talk about? Because it's a weird balance between sharing, not oversharing, and then you're kind of trying to keep yourself on an even keel as well. So you're like, thank you though. I really appreciate that. How do you plan? I have two final questions. The last one is to ask you to recommend a book. You can think about that while we're chatting on the second last question. How do you plan out? Because you seem quite organized. You seem quite strategic. Mm-hmm. How do you plan out, say, your week, your month, your quarter, your year? Do you have a system you use?
Yeah. The thing about planning is like, it's kind of like the 80-20 principle. There's probably only a handful of things that really move the dial. Mm. So like, if I say when I was just after raising the seed round, if I looked forward to like a year and a half time, what would be an impressive thing to be able to say, or what would be an impressive thing to have accomplished? And for me, it was like, oh, we're in one or two of the big four. And now we're in that. So that kind of a bit like sets your milestones for you. We've hired a head of engineering, and there's a lot of minutiae as a founder that can creep in, like, oh, I need to like send off the stuff for the VAT return, or maybe I should do this competition entry. But like, I try to look at it as in 6 months down the line or a year down the line, what are the things that will really move the dial? And honestly, it's going to be less than a page. You know, it's, you can complicate it as much as you want, but it's probably going to be one or two main things. Like, for now, it's like, we need to raise a funding round, we need to get our first international sales, we need to improve the technology and get our system built. How does that translate into kind of a month to month or week to week thing? I'm kind of a fan of, you know, the Stephen Covey book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Yeah. And he talks about big rocks, that big rocks are those things that move the needle. And normally they're the bit of kind of, they're slightly thankless. You know, you just have to kind of sit down and do them and push them ahead. You're not maybe going to get the immediate dopamine of doing something smaller. So say in our office, we'd write our big rocks on the whiteboard. So then they're just staring you in the face and you kind of have to get them done. Another way I try and hold myself accountable is in our quarterly investor updates, I'll, you know, tell the investors in by the next quarter, we'll have done X, Y, and Z, or we'll aim to have done X, Y, or Z. So then that kind of sort of Damocles.
That's serious like, skin in the game
get you motivated. Because I think you can maybe hide behind a little bit like vagueness in things like that. So I'll just kind of say, look, we will have done this.
How do you find the balance though between pushing yourself enough that it's a big enough challenge with also mm-hmm. being achievable? How do you find that balance?
I think that for the founder, like a lot of your job is to think. You're trying to like extract yourself from the minutiae of the day-to-day. And I kind of like the thinking bit. Like, I feel like having this job is like having this really interesting Rubik's Cube that you can be like I don't know, messing away at like at all areas of the day and night. So probably don't really find the thinking or strategizing. Like I do enjoy it. I suppose I wouldn't want to bring down too much pressure on the team. But to date, because we're at like product market fit and a relatively early stage, it's been okay, we achieved these big rocks, and then it's okay, we won't overstretch ourselves. Because I just from observation and you know like reading about other companies, sometimes the thing that brings down like a good company is overstretching yourself or operationalizing things before you're ready to. So it's just being like a little bit attentive to that. And like, I think, you know, yourself or, you know, from dealing with the team, if things are getting a bit too stressy, and it's fine if it's maybe for a week or a month or something, but if this is going to win, like it's a marathon, not a sprint. So I'm just conscious that we can't burn ourselves out. So we have to kind of strike that balance as well. I think that if you are burnt out, like it reduces the power of your decision-making, and that's the kind of main thing that
it's overlooked a lot. People think, by pushing myself harder, it'll suddenly get better, when in reality you're actually diminishing the cognitive ability.
And like that's the reason why I suppose customers have entrusted you with money to build a product, or why investors have given you money, or why the team have given their time and their talents. Like, they're kind of not paying for you to work yourself to the bone. It's for you to make good, strategically wise decisions that allow the company to last into the long term. So I suppose I just try to think of that. And then if all else fails, just go for a really long run and tire yourself out. So,
if all else fails. What has been a book that's made an impact on you personally or professionally?
Yeah,
it can't be a textbook.
Scratch that. Going back to Naval Ravikant, so like he hasn't written a book as such, but a bunch of his tweets and kind of transcripts from podcast appearances, you're probably familiar with this.
It's so mad, isn't it? It's absolutely mad.
Being consolidated into Naval's almanac, I think it's called, by a guy called Eric Jorgensen. And what I love about it, it's almost like the full stack that you need to be a founder. So there is a philosophy piece. He kind of talks about happiness and peacefulness and what it means to live a meaningful, fulfilled life, and then works down into what that means for your mental and physical health, and then works down to like what that looks like as a founder or someone working in a business. And it's kind of fully integrated. Like, you know, he sees all those things as connected, like everything's a bit downstream from your philosophy. But then you have to make sure you look after your mind and your body. And there's lots of really practical tips about like how you actually run a business, like the concept of leverage, like absorbing that as a principle.
Yes.
And what are the things that bring you leverage?
That was one of the things I really took from him. Because you get so, as you said, you get so lost in the minutiae. Sometimes it feels good. Oh, I'll just bang out a quick email. Bing! You've got your dopamine hit. Yeah. Whereas in reality, you shouldn't be touching it. That shouldn't even be a thing for you. You know, you're just the leverage there is zero. You've just done something that's zero. You know, whereas should you be doing something that's 100x? That it's good.
If you could kind of sit down and say, write a program that automates 20% of, say, your user interactions or something like that, and leverage in the form of other capital, employees, code, or digital media. So I just kind of love that moving between the philosophical components, like the emphasis on living a happy life and a good life, but then actually the nuts and bolts of how to be a good founder. So yeah, I love it. And it's in kind of easy to consume, nicely written format. So yeah.
And it's never been recommended before.
Oh God.
So I'm delighted.
Hopefully the first of many.
Yeah, it's class. It's never been, I love to get a new recommendation. That's brilliant. Where can people learn a little bit more about yourself and Examfly?
Yeah, we're on examfly.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I wouldn't say I have a major social media presence beyond that, but
probably better off.
LinkedIn, examfly.com.
Examfly.com. Yeah. Dee, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Gary. That was brilliant. Thank you.
If you made this all the way to the end, thank you so much. I want you to go on social media right now and send me a message and tell me what was the one key lesson you picked up from Dee, because she packed a lot in there. As I said, I love this episode. Do get in touch, let me know what you think, and also please share it with someone. Share this episode with one person you think will learn from it. I will see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab.